Hello and welcome to the Occult Sentinel Podcast, Episode 3. Today I'll be speaking with EIO131. He is the editor and a contributor to the new Journal of Thelemic Studies. It's currently on its second release with a bunch of new essays and artwork. And I suggest you all check it out. So without further ado, here we go with the interview. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Tonight I'll be speaking with EIO131, editor and contributor of the new Journal of Thelemic Studies. Very nice journal. I suggest you all check it out. So let me open the floor to you. Could you tell us a little bit about the journal?
Hi, thanks. The journal, well, the stated purpose of the journal is that it was created to foster the most modern and current thought in the Thelemic community. And we thought this would best be done by propagating the literature of various authors who have all their varying opinions on different subjects of Thelema. And the subject matter of the journal isn't necessarily one certain ideology within Thelema, but we try to give an equal voice to all those divergent and perhaps even conflicting viewpoints that we find with different individuals. And the journal's explicitly nonpartisan in that sense, that we don't try to enforce any sort of group's view of Thelema. And the journal isn't affiliated in any way with the Estate of Crowley or Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, or any other formal Thelemic organization.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's a very important thing to have a nonpartisan journal out there for people to discuss this stuff in an academic way.
Yeah, we take inspiration from psychology and physics journals where they collect the best minds of their field in one area, and in this age of information, the age of the internet, I think it's important to get everyone together in one place and be able to share this information easily and in an accessible way, which is one reason that we offer the journal for free for those that wish to read it and not commit money.
Yeah, cool. So what topics are you primarily interested in discussing in the journal?
Well, it's Thelemic studies, so anything that's a study of Thelema. We're really just looking to stimulate intellectual discourse on the subject of Thelema, the works of Aleister Crowley in general. And basically, Thelema has repercussions in almost every area of thought, from basics of philosophy and metaphysics to ethics, and even just a practical way of life. It has something to offer for everyone. And so, really, there's an infinite amount of potential topics that could be covered. We don't try to narrow it down too far. In fact, one complaint I got relatively consistently was that the journal was too intellectual. In the sense that Thelemic studies doesn't necessarily refer to just literary essays and intellectual diatribes and discussions. And so in this new issue that we're putting out, the second number of Volume 1, we have an interview with the band Illuminati, and we are also branching out into the more visual arts and trying to focus on painting and Thelemic art. So really there's no limit.
Cool, yeah, I really did enjoy the art by the only, who is it, the lady from the Middle East, the only camp member, Layla, yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah, we included one image by her and a photograph by Gerald Del Campo in the first issue to sort of balance out all the words in there.
Yeah, that was cool. Nice balance, yeah. So how frequently do you plan on publishing your journal?
Well, we plan on publishing twice a year, once in the winter and once in the spring, and we're just about to release the second issue. It might be out by the time this podcast is broadcasted, I'm not sure.
Cool.
But we're basically looking at twice a year. The point is we're looking for good quality over just quantity because, like I said, it's an information age and there's so much information out there. We want to get all of the pertinent and concise information in one place.
Interesting. Okay, so are you still looking for submissions for the third?
Yeah, we are always looking for submissions, and you don't have to be a high officer in the OTO or anything of any real authority to submit, because every man and every woman is a star, and everyone has an opinion that can be heard, and often they're quite useful to hear, and so anyone can submit. We're always looking for submissions of all types.
Great. So I saw you had a pretty interesting forum going on the Thelemic Studies website. What are you trying to do there?
Well, there's a few interesting discussions going on at the forums. We initially had a website that was just very basic and just had a few basic text links to get around, but thought it would be better to have sort of a locus or a community to build around Thelemic Studies. And many people are interested in discussing these materials and have messaged me and emailed me various questions that I thought would be best if other people could have their say in their discussion, since I'm not the sole authority on Thelema, of course. And so we updated the site and give it a news feed so you can be updated on current events in Thelema, and gave it a forums for people of all types to chat on. And we've had people, psychologists, occultists, Thelemites, anarchists, all types of people come on to chat and give their say about various topics.
Great, yeah. I only browsed it for about 10 minutes, but it's very interesting for the short amount of time I spent there. So I guess let's start talking about your essay, The Psychological Commentary on Liberal.
Sure.
First, I'd like to say you probably have some kind of background in psychology, right?
Right.
Yeah, so very interesting article. I suggest everybody that's listening to this podcast at least check out that portion of the journal. And let me mention, it can be free if you want to download the PDF, but you can also purchase a copy from lulu.com.
Yes, at thelemicstudies.com.
Thelemicstudies.com, yes. Okay, so in your essay, something I never really thought of before in terms of the HGA of Crowley-Iwas, the suggestion you made that Iwas was actually the subconscious of Crowley,
right.
And this would actually have, well, you could view it in almost an atheistic sense, I guess, but it was kind of generated in his subconscious out of material he exposed himself to throughout mm-hmm. his life. Could you talk
right.
about that shortly?
Yeah, sure, and it has lots of interesting implications if you choose to view it that way, and I'm not really asserting that this is the way it is. I think it's definitely an interesting way to go about looking at it, and I also think it is useful to go about looking at it this way. And Crowley himself used various terminology like subconscious to describe these various facets. And so basically one of the main theses of the psychological commentary is that psychology itself treats all these proclamations in sacred texts and religious texts, etc., and channelings, for example, as mental phenomena and manifestations of the unconscious. And many people are averse to this because they say, oh, you're reducing it to the human psyche or the human body, and this somehow makes things less impressive or less wonderful. And I think it just makes them all the more beautiful, all the more wonderful, that the psyche can produce such powerful and amazing figures and ideas. And certainly the unconscious has powers that we are not consciously aware of in our normal ego functioning. And so really it's just, it's, there's an infinite amount of potential to tap into in your unconscious. And so it's really not reducing anything to say that Liberel Belligis is a psychological product. I think that's just showing how amazing the human psyche is, and it also shows the potential for each one of us to create great things, since each of us has a psyche. And basically there's a lot of implications that the Holy Guardian Angel is your subconscious or unconscious, and instead of some kind of deity or anything. And many people have an idea of Holy Guardian Angel as some kind of separate individual, or even some kind of higher self that's all of their best qualities that they think about, that it's very true or very good, and they think about all their supposedly best qualities, and they form their Holy Guardian Angel out of this intellectual ideal. And both of those don't really make much sense in terms of viewing the Holy Guardian Angel as the self, as the subconscious self, rather, because obviously this subconscious self is not an individual outside of yourself. But interestingly, the subconscious can manifest things as if they were individuals outside of yourself. And I think the best example of this is dreams, where you encounter various figures and even environments that most people acknowledge come from their psyches. And this is, it's just an interesting fact that subconscious energies, subconscious potentials can express themselves in a sort of personified way. And so that also gives credence to the psychological hypothesis of the creation of the Book of the Law. And also the subconscious, really, it contains those things that we think of as our highest qualities and also perhaps our lowest, our good and our bad qualities. And so it really dispenses with the idea that this Holy Guardian Angel is some kind of ideal that will bring good to the world and kill all evil. It's really a bringing ourselves to wholeness, because if you think about it, there, if there's a self and there's a subconscious aspect of it, then our conscious aspect of the self is obviously just a small part of ourselves. It's just a simple fact that our ego, our conscious functioning, is a small facet of our entire self. Freud has a famous metaphor where the psyche is an iceberg and the unconscious functioning is all those parts of the iceberg that are underwater. And that small bit of the iceberg that's above water is that conscious part of our psyche. And so really it can be this knowledge and conversation of Holy Guardian Angel, which is a phrase that is used often by Thelemites, can be seen as identical to Jungian individuation, which is a psychological term for finding your wholeness, your true self, which contains both conscious and unconscious facets.
Yeah, I think there is a lot in what you just said, certainly.
There's many different implications that can come about from contemplating this, and I think the most interesting is the fact that it sort of brings together various ideas of the idea of individuation in psychology, the idea of knowledge and conversation, of the Holy Guardian Angel and Thelema, also the more hermetic alchemical term of the great work. All those type of ideas can be unified in this sort of psychological terminology of coming to know and integrate that those unconscious aspects of yourself.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think one interesting point here, one of the thousands of implications, is that if this were purely a psychological phenomena, that would have nothing to do with physical reality. In a sense, it still totally twists the standard materialistic worldview. in a very interesting way.
Yeah, well, the subjective viewpoint of the psyche doesn't necessarily need to coincide with some kind of objective, absolute idea of the world, in the sense that, for example, if you look at the diagrams of alchemists and you see that they're geocentric, they have the earth at the center. Now, as a map of the outside world and the physical universe, that's obviously false because we live in a heliocentric solar system. But from a psychological point of view, this map is still very valid. We see the world as if we are the center. And the earth being a symbol of our body or the concrete aspect of ourself, we certainly view things as if they emanate from the center. And so that's just one example of how a psychological map doesn't have to necessarily coincide with these physical realities. But still, nonetheless, the human psyche has its basis in human biology. And Jung himself wrote that the collective unconscious, which is simply that substratum of the unconscious that all humans share and have similar across the species, that all is founded in the uniformity of our physiology, our body. And so what I'm saying is that really it may seem like there's a cleft, but there are definite connections. The psyche itself is the interaction of material forms by many accounts. The psyche's manifestations are actually a reflection on a certain plane of those material processes.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, I guess let's move on to another portion of your essay that I thought was pretty interesting. You discussed, was it your essay where you discussed the chapter 3 material with Horace?
Right, that's in the essay Philema and Buddhism.
Okay. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that passage in Liberal and
sure.
Maybe Chud, I guess, passing over to that portion of the conversation. It's no longer really psychological. It's more Liberal commentary.
Well, first of all, in any kind of interpretation or comment to the Book of the Law, I have to admit it's entirely personal and subjective, and I'm not claiming this is the interpretation, but in Liber L, there's pretty well-known passage in the third chapter where major religions of the past, actually their figureheads are sort of symbolically attacked and cursed. And many people find this distasteful, that it's barbaric, that it's unnecessary, etc. And I think it really should be investigated. The whole essay is really viewing these lines in the context of what Crowley was studying at the time, which was a lot of Buddhism, and also just in the context of his general attitude towards these religions, which was, in general, one of great respect, even though it also was accompanied with great skepticism. And I think basically the thesis that's put forward in that essay is that this cursing is sort of a curse against the dogmatism that's inherent in these different systems of the superstition and the tyranny that comes from it. And so when we're cursing these different systems of Christianity and Buddhism and Islam, really the Book of the Law, rather, is cursing these, they curse the point of view and their practices, which is that they're not effective, they're not very true, etc. And in another part of the Book of the Law, it says all words are sacred, preceded by the word Om from the Hindu tradition. And so obviously there's a certain respect running through even the Book of the Law, let alone Crowley's writings, which are chock full of references to Buddhism and Hindu concepts that he picked up. And so, taking in the context of his reverence for these systems, it becomes obvious that it's essentially a clearing away of all the weeds from the garden, so to say, in the sense that we're clearing away all those dogmas and superstitions that have impeded us in the past. And in Book of the Law, these are symbolized by the various leaders, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, etc.
I'd like to actually read the passage, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Okay. I am in a secret fourfold word, the blasphemy against all gods of men. Curse them, curse them, curse them. With my hawk's head, this actually being Horus, I peck the eyes of Jesus as he hangs upon the cross. I flap my wings in the face of Muhammad and blind him. With my claws, I tear out the flesh of the Indian and the Buddhist, Mongol and Din. Bahasti, Thelema, I spit on your crapulous creeds. Liberal 3:49-54. So, interesting passage. It takes a lot of people by surprise to find it.
I think a lot of lines in the Book of the Law take people by surprise. But I think, really, the central message of the book is, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. There is no law beyond do what thou wilt. And in this context, you have to understand, what is cursing these religions and these traditions do for me? How does it help my will? Why would it even be there? And from this point of view, it seems, just from a pragmatic point of view, it seems to be a curse against, for example, when the eyes are attacked. Crowley interprets this as their metaphysical point of view being based in error, based in ideas like original sin and various metaphysical ideas that permeate those thought and therefore have an effect on the individuals that follow them. And also, Crowley interprets the attack on their bodies as an attack on their practice, as being founded in principles that aren't resonant with the ones in Thelema.
It's interesting to consider that a lot of these Indian gurus and Buddhist masters actually cling relatively tightly to their own dogmas, but in a sense they eventually transcend them, but they do push them on the neophytes in those orders. And I see a trend in Thelema to, or people interested in Thelemic philosophy, to actually try to tell you that you can't really know too much. All you can do is really know your own experience, and how much do you even really know of that?
Right, well, I think Thelema is set aside from other occult philosophies in that continual growth is really the mainstay, the idea being put forward and not some kind of final goal or purpose. Even knowledge and conversation of Holy Garden Angel, Crowley said something like it constitutes occult puberty, not the end of your life or the end of your attainment. It sort of signals the beginning. And so even these high attainments are a means to help manifest and facilitate your will. Crowley wrote that the joy of life consists in the exercise of one's energies, continual growth, constant change, the enjoyment of every new experience. To stop means simply to die. The eternal mistake of mankind is to set up an attainable ideal. And in that sense, even ideals are a restriction to your will. And the Book of the Law says the word of sin is restriction. And so when you put limits even on what you think you can know, it's still a restriction. Why not just accept that you may be ignorant about many facets of life, but you can go your way and learn more, experience more, assimilate more experiences, and thereby become more and more a manifestor of your will.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, so pretty much exploration, observation, and reassessment seem to be pretty core. Even if you think you reached samadhi, there's still so much more you can do than that. Mm. Yeah.
Right. And observation, self-assessment, those are all inherent in the fact that to do your will, you have to first know thyself and know your nature and to help more fully manifest this will. And if you're clouded over with judgments enforced by other people throughout your life, if you have society telling you what your needs and wants should be, then obviously these are impediments that should be discarded. That those are the first things that you come up against in self-introspection and this process of self-realization, is these various barriers that are put up that you have to discard.
Yeah. Yeah, so, let's see. Well, one of the questions I put down, I don't know how much we'll get out of it, but let's try it anyway. What are the next big projects that you think occultists and Thelemites need to tackle these days?
Next big projects?
Yeah, as vague as that is.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest project every occultist and Thelemite needs to tackle is the great work, of course.
Yeah.
Of self-realization. But aside from this, on a more material level, I'd really like to see Thelemites not relying on OTO so much to form communities. And this is already really starting up with a lot of people, but a lot of times they look to existing organizations to sort of order their wills and their various outlets of creation. And I think it would be best if people maintained a little more individualism in this sense, as weird as that may seem from a Thelemite.
Well, no, I don't think it's that weird, because it does seem a little restrictive, at least in the last couple of years.
I don't mean to put the OTO down. It does good work in various ways, especially in publishing certain books. But I think, really, there's a lot of opportunities that people don't take advantage of because their energies are put into the OTO. And I think there may be a lot of benefit if people started looking to each other to form more independent groups. And that's just the basis of doing your will, going your own way. And it's just a suggestion. But in occultism in general, I would also like to see communities arising where people share their methods and their results clearly and honestly. There's a website, arrowid.org, I think, that sort of catalogs the various experiences people have taking different substances and drugs and such. I think one good idea might be to have a sort of compendium of occultists' experiences and the methods they use to get their visions and their trances, etc.
I'm very familiar with that site. That's an interesting concept there to actually, I think the people that run that site would actually be open to that, to really archiving information there openly.
Right, and one of their emphases is on cataloging, what substance, how much, your weight, when it was. And another thing I'd like to see is people wedding modern science to the old methods of occultism. And Crowley himself did this, having a whole system he called scientific illuminism, where the aim was religion and the method was science, etc. And there's a lot of great research, especially in neuroscience, that could be wedded to the knowledge of occultists. And I can't foresee all the developments, but I'm sure people could make some great syntheses and some great leaps forward.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty bizarre stuff lately coming out of internet chaos magic circles where they're using computers, iPods, laptops, TVs, all sorts of things to aid in their rituals, which I think is a pretty interesting development.
Yeah, that's great. That's chaos magicians are often very close to Thelemites. Often some Thelemites are chaos magicians and vice versa, just labels anyhow. But chaos magicians, the use of these computers, etc., as symbols and talismans, that's great. That obviously shows they're integrating the new stimuli and knowledge that are coming in. I think Austin Spare was the one that decried the lack of automotive symbols and the fact that we aren't integrating all these new symbols into our psyches, but obviously some are.
That's a good point. Yeah, we got more mileage out of that question than I thought we would. cool. let's see. Are you familiar with Richard Mesker and the disinformation publications?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
He used to have a TV show called The Infinity Factor. In one episode of that, Robert Anton Wilson attended. And one of the most interesting things he brought up may seem blasphemous, but I guess blasphemy is in right now.
Hit me.
The Book of the Law, what if Crowley spent a significant amount of time and actually made this as a forgery? He did it himself and built in all of this symbolism on his own. What kind of implications can we pull out of that? How realistic does it sound? You know, what do we get out of that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that he went bankrupt funding these operations and publishing his own books. So either he didn't have a very good monetary strategy or it backfired in that regard. But also, I think a line from the Book of the Law itself is pertinent here, which is success is your proof. And the fact is that even if the book was a complete joke or a complete forgery, people could still take away from it extremely sublime and profound insights. And the fact is that there are apparent attempts at solving various metaphysical riddles, various answers and commands given. And really, I think they should be judged based on how true we feel them to be, how effective they are in employing them. And Crowley spent a great deal of time expounding various parts of Thelema, how it affected various facets of ethics and politics and education. And so if it was a forgery, it was an excessively extensive one. And also a useful one.
yeah.
But I wouldn't take it as blasphemous because I'm personally not one of those people who... I see him as a great prophet, just like Buddha, just like many other figures. Even Nietzsche I consider somewhat of a prophet. But the fact is that if you take Lieber L to be a creation of the psychology, it's just one next step to take the Bible and Upanishads, the Dhammapada, all those as manifestations of the unconscious. And so really it in that sense too, they're on equal ground. And that's...
Yeah, I agree. There's no matter what, even if it was a forgery, there's still great content there and mysteries we can glean out of it.
Yeah, I think the people who are averse to that most are the people who have a little too much attachment to the system, honestly. And really, there's one part in Thelema and Buddhism where I mentioned that if a certain line turns out to be wrong, either we can just admit that the book is wrong or simply say that our interpretation of it is skewed or incorrect itself. and we should adjust. We shouldn't just stay in our fundamentalist ideas of this and this has to be right because it's written here and was interpreted as this way for a really long time. That isn't necessary, and really implicit in the message of Thelema itself is growth and adaptation and manipulation of circumstances to just help manifest your will better. And in that case, it may turn out that new interpretations of the Book of Law bring new life, they bring new meaning. And really, it's that view is contradicted by a few Thelemites who stick to a pretty fundamentalist view. I think that the best way to go about it is to really read what Crowley said about all these topics, and then sort of see what the texts themselves, the Book of the Law, says, because it seems there's almost two levels, the book and Crowley's commentary thereon, which the commentaries fluctuated a lot, yet he felt the books themselves should stay the same. And Crowley's comments, they show a lot about how he felt about Thelema at a certain point, what he was thinking, even, and from his commentaries, you can see, first of all, that there isn't one interpretation of a line. He gives several interpretations of "do what thou wilt" itself, and he, from various viewpoints, like a Kabbalistic standpoint, etc. And so, really, I think it's implicit in Thelema to sort of adapt and not let these more fundamental grasping onto Crowley said it once, and therefore, if we don't accept it, I don't really know. There's nothing really to lose by adapting. It's just people with attachment to these ideas seem to be threatened by the sense that, oh, if he's not some divinity, some god incarnated or anything, then the message loses its validity. But I don't think so, because of what I said before, that it success is your proof, and Book of the Law, I think many of its messages are quite successful if applied.
Yeah, it seems anti-scientific illuminist to remain dogmatic and superstitious about particular lines Crowley said during his different stages of his life, because of course during the whole course of your life you're going to contradict yourself here or there.
Right. And I think many people lose sight of the fact of just "do what thou wilt" shall be the whole of the law. There is no law beyond "do what thou wilt." And it may seem trivial, but juxtaposed with those lines, a lot of other lines seem pretty trivial, or they're put into perspective, rather.
And now in one of the AA documents I've read, it was kind of the postcard sent out to people before they took initiation. It kind of laid out some theorems.
Postcards to probationers?
I believe so. Are you familiar with that?
I am.
Yeah, it was a very interesting document. And it just laid out theorems, like all of these prophets essentially wrote nonsense.
Right, because truth is supra-rational, and so any sort of reasonable grasp of it won't do it full justice.
Yeah, and essentially he lays out that through yoga and magic you can unleash your true will on the world and be a genius like these guys were.
Right.
Yeah, so that kind of laid it out in pretty plain English for me.
Right, and it's also the idea that yoga and magic are essentially one method, and that it's essentially the art of uniting the mind to a single idea, which is a yoga method for attainment.
Yeah. So another thing I found interesting, I believe this was still, I lost track, I read it. A couple of your essays, I can't keep them straight right now, but one was interesting, and you had this dichotomy between mysticism and magic being the will to or the desire towards life, and mysticism being kind of the desire to die.
Right.
Can we talk about that?
Sure. There's various lines in Book of the Law that talk about going this way or that way, and there's one specific line where Hadith is curled like a serpent ready to strike and sort of gives two options of becoming one with earth and becoming one with heaven, with Nuit. And I just sort of drew a hypothetical dichotomy of that the will is manifested both in this will to life, sort of, which is more of a material, putting your energy into matter, and a will to death, which in my mind is synonymous with the dissolution of yourself in union with God, as one metaphor, or knowledge and conversation of Holy Guardian Angel. And so it's sort of a spirit-matter dichotomy, but they're ultimately not separated, I think. But I sort of drew parallels with Freud's death instincts, the death drive, the life instinct, and also with two concepts in a obscure treatise by Jung called Septem Sermones Ad Mortuos, Seven Sermons to the Dead, where he talks about this heavenly mother and Phallus, the earthly father, which I thought were great symbolic depictions of these two methods of manifesting the will. And essentially, I was contemplating the fact, again, that the self contains both conscious and unconscious facets. It has the propensity for creating and destroying, and has the drive towards assimilating and being assimilated, etc., etc. And so, really, I found that you can't sort of confine the will to a will to life or a will to death, and really that the will manifests in both of these, and they're manifested more abstractly in a symbolic sense with this will to put forth your energy into matter or put forth your energy into union with the divine.
Yeah. There's a lot to chew on there. You know, which article was that, so we can actually point listeners to that, or essay?
That's in the psychological commentary to Liber L, which you can find at eao131.cjb.net, and it's just a chapter, a little section in the psychological commentary. You can also go to lulu.com/eao131 if you want a hard copy of it.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize you published the rest of a bunch of your essays there.
Yeah, I published that one because a few people were asking me for a hard copy. I haven't really gotten my writings together for a single publication yet. I've been focusing more on the journal and getting all of that stuff together.
Yeah. Yeah, if anybody's interested in checking out these articles, I highly recommend them. There's a lot of depth to them and insight you can glean out of them.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I guess the next question or point... Well, actually, let me look at my list here. Now, I had some thoughts recently about the nature of these darker gods, like Osiris, Set, Lucifer, Cthulhu, and what does it really mean to be a dark god, and what is the human interaction with these entities? What's the nature of this interaction? Is it earthly, left-hand path? What's your take on this?
Right. Well, I think earthly, left-hand path, those are all sort of arbitrary labels in the sense that really, I think again, these are just manifestations of the unconscious and symbols specifically of the chaos of the unconscious and also the terribleness of the unconscious. I'm not going to lie, it's not a happy place. And power isn't always expressed in blooming flowers, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so the fact is that these are apt symbols of the unconscious and of that self that resides beyond the unconscious. And it is a terrible thing to come into contact with your true self. Terrible in the sense that it's an overwhelming power, and sometimes it's a little scary to see your old self fall away to this new perspective. And, you know, they say Osiris is a black god and all these different things. I think that just points towards the fact that we have to accept and integrate these black parts of our nature and what Jung calls the shadow, that aspect of us we deny. And in Liebert Sadi, Crowley writes about these two marriages, symbolic marriages that you make. And one is with the upper and one is with the lower creature of slime. And he says, some tell you to make the union with the upper, some with the lower. I tell you to make both, because both are one. And really, I think it comes from a sort of false dichotomy that people set up, that the good things are above, the bad things are below, even though good and bad is really tempered by what culture you're brought up in. And so in coming to an initiation, it seems sort of like the upper and lower coming together, the horrible black creatures and the creatures of light. They're both there, and they're both facets of the psyche. And for true individuation or true wholeness to come about, you have to encompass all those facets of yourself. And I think those symbols specifically are a good pointer towards the darker aspects that we neglect, that we are in a special need of integrating.
I have a pretty strong interest in transpersonal psychology, Stanislav Grof in particular. One of the biggest things he contributed to psychology is the concept of spiritual emergence, and that kind of corresponds to the EIO formula of, you know, kind of normal status quo living, death, and then rebirth into kind of as a stronger phoenix into this new mode of being.
Right.
And exactly. It seems like this commerce with your subconscious or other worlds, it kind of brings you to new heights because you have to keep reliving that formula. You have to keep dying and being reborn.
Right.
Into a new self.
Yeah.
Very interesting concept.
The formula itself, it can refer to one point event where opposites coincide and bring about a third, but it really is a formula for all moments, even in that you and your environment come together and each of you is changed a little bit in each moment. And in a more mystical sense, we were talking before about how Thelema differs from other occultists in that it explicitly says that, you know, we need continual growth, and setting up attainable ideals is mankind's eternal mistake. And in this sense, Iao is just a symbol of that process that must continually go on as we expand under in various forms of our expression of our will, love under will, and incorporating different elements of the environment, different facts of knowledge, and different experiences. So it's an ongoing process, of course.
Yeah, and that's troubling to a lot of people because in their minds they think of their standard working life, their 401k, pensions, whatever, their retirement, and they think they can do the same thing with their spiritual life too.
Right.
Probably not the case. They'll be unfulfilled and unwhole.
Definitely. A lot of people are also seeking a sort of comfort in equilibrium, when really I think the real sort of equilibrium is the one that you get on a bicycle by pedaling continually instead of sitting in one place. You need a sort of perpetual motion to keep yourself stable, and that some sort of ending place, a resting place, a final equilibrium is almost a sign of weakness, that you don't want to keep going on and keep conquering and overcoming, performing acts of love under will, and manifesting your will more fully.
This kind of comes under the umbrella of mysticism, but there's a Zen parable about process. Life is an unending process, and there's no real end point except for when you die, at least on this plane. The Zen master pretty much suggested that life is pretty much just you're on this boat going down the river, and you're continually bailing out the boat. you're doing all this work to stay up, and die.
Well, I mean, life is work there, but you can take that notion and say, well, gosh, I hate the world and I think it's all suffering and all of this sucks. I just want to get out of here. Or you can say yes and affirm this process and say with Book of the Law, existence is pure joy, because really, in the sense of taking away finishing points and ideals to attain, you can say, oh, it's so meaningless. There's no meaning if there's no goals. But really, you can take the contrasting point that where every moment is a sort of goal in itself, and existence itself, every moment, is joy. This idea is all over Thelemic texts, like there's joy in the setting out, there's joy in the journey, and there's joy in the goal. It's showing that there's joy at all parts of this, and that you continue in this joy. Also, things like, therefore, the beginning is the delight, the end is the delight is in the myths, etc. It's a continuing idea that even purpose is a restriction into your will, and getting rid of these ideals also gives us freedom to express our joy at the moment and the gratitude for all these different moments in the all points in our growth from the beginning to the end when we die.
Yeah, very, very interesting. If we want to keep it to an hour, I may want to ask one last question, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
All right, great. This kind of goes to Crowley's non-dualistic tendencies, but he wanted to be delivered beyond good and evil. I think right. That's a point very worth discussing and very...
Certainly. Well, the phrase most likely comes from Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil, a book he wrote, and it deals with morality, with values, and the idea of values has a large repercussion on doing your will, obviously, and the first thing you might think of is that the values that are introjected, the values that are given to you by society and peers, those aren't necessarily the values most conducive to doing your will. And so, in this sense, we have to get beyond value prescriptions from other people and from society. But it also goes deeper in the sense that really all these value judgments are relative and part of a sort of relative scheme with no absolute validity. And what is good to one person is bad or evil to another person and vice versa. And that idea is sort of summarized by Nietzsche's aphorism, which is something like, there is no such thing as mental phenomena. There is simply mental interpretation of moral interpretation of phenomena. And so the morality lies in the interpretation, which is subjective and relative, and the goodness and the evilness doesn't reside in the action itself or the thing itself. And really it doesn't exist at all except in people's heads. And the line right after "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law" is that the word of sin is restriction. And the most basic form of restriction I can think of is someone coming to me and saying, "Thou shalt do X and Y," or "Thou shalt not do X and Y." And those are just the basic of these moral prescriptions of this code of conduct is good, this code of conduct is evil, and you need to obey. And that's just fundamentally swept away in Thelema, because the will is not some sort of universal standard that everyone is trying to hold themselves up to, like being like Jesus or being like a super reasonable Kant with his categorical imperative. And so saying "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law" is essentially a sweep across all of ethics, all of anything that proclaims any sort of absolute code of conduct, any sort of absolute value system of what is good and what is bad. And it's sort of that the line beyond good and evil speaks to this fact that these valuations are just ultimately relative and restrictive. They can only be useful if they come from yourself. And even then, they can be misleading, and we often take them to be final and absolute. Whereas, really, I think the best idea is to have a sort of dynamic approach to the world in our values, which is that our values can be amended, and they can be changed and adapted, and we can get rid of those values which are detrimental to what we feel is manifesting our will, and we can help those values grow, which we think are best. And I think it just gets to the point of both the fact that we need to get beyond simple value judgments from others of what is good and what is evil, but also just the duality of value judgments itself.
Great. Well, thanks for going over that for us. It's always a very interesting thing to discuss because it runs so deep, you know, from the time we were able to understand words from whoever raised us. It was kind of like, no, don't right. do that. No, okay, that's bad because they told me it was.
Right.
And so ingrained.
We basically interject these values and come to think of them as our own eventually, which many people do, yet a certain dissonance inside of many people, most aspirants, is what brings people to realize that these values that have been given to me are not that great. They're not based in truth, nor are they helpful. And so it's just a basic fact of anyone who is an aspirant, an occultist, even anyone who just has a little self-introspection to come to face these values that have been interjected since day one.
Great. Okay. So I guess it's about time to round it up.
Sure.
So everybody listening, the two websites I suggest you check out, Yao131 runs all of them, or both of them, thelemicstudies.com and EIO131.cjb.net. Again, that's the letter I, O, A. No, sorry. IAO131.cjb.net and thelemicstudies.com. Again, he also has books on lulu.com if you'd like to get a hard copy of any of his documents. So any closing thoughts for us?
just like to remind people that the first issue and the second issue, when it becomes available, are available for free on the website, thelemicstudies.com. You don't necessarily have to pay for them.
Great. Great. Well, thank you for joining me. And 93.
Thanks for having me, 93.
So there you have it, a long and thought-provoking interview of EIO-131. I hope everybody reads the journal and checks out EIO-131's other essays. I'll have a link to his sites up on the show notes. On a side note, I would like to let everybody know that this podcast and all other podcasts on the site are going to be licensed under the Creative Commons Share Alike Attribution 3.0 license. So essentially it's free. Share it. If you're into music, sample it and remix it. Do what you want. Put it on your own podcast, but just link back. So what else? I'm trying to solicit some feedback on the podcast. I've noticed about 100 downloads so far between episodes 1 and 2. I'm publishing episodes 3 and 4 pretty much on the same day. On the same day. And I'd like to get some feedback on what people think. So please leave some comments on the website or email me. The email address for the podcast is podcast@eastern-syndicate.com. So podcast@eastern-syndicate.com. In between Eastern and Syndicate, there's a hyphen. On the very first post of the website, you'll see a link there. So yeah, send me some email. If it's relevant, maybe I'll even read it and comment on it. That tickles your funny bone. So here's some closing music, and hopefully I get some feedback.
Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and coming from the 334 via cyberspace. That's WW, it's your favorite MC. And my
wizard man is under. First off, I'm not your regular dude. I bust moves like a young MC. Yeah, sorta, that would be me. Got me thinking about putting down the mic one day. Then I get some more love. Thanks for the love you gotta play. Hey, what can I say? I'm a Leo to the finish, man. I love God, so my faith won't diminish, man. Once I step up to the mic, I speak truth. Hip-hop wasn't designed to exploit the black youth. But somewhere along the lines, we dropped the ball, yeah. I mean, that man in the mirror, yeah, that ball dude. But now I'm back to right the wrongs of my past world. So let me mark this off my list like my name is Earl. Articulate my thoughts clearly like Professor Laz. Do you remember Rap City with Desure and Laz? I'm looking at the front door, bless the main source. You're full, yeah, wait till I hit you with the main course. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you brag about it? I be on solo, making my money grow residual. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you brag about it? I be on solo, making my money grow residual. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA. Like my raps, but really I write songs. I like to do it like this once in a while to show some versatility and make you all smile. It's been a long time coming, I know, I feel it too. The more I take a break, it's like the more I break through. With my time, the space boy funk, I'm on point. You bless this microphone every time I anoint the pen, the pad. I face the bad head on, escape inside the music. See my diaries, the song it's on. Till I write my next verse, then I go again into the studio. I feel like I gotta flow again. This ain't just music to me, it's like my recipe. To be honest, it's more creative tranquility. This ain't just music to me, it's like my recipe. To be honest, it's more creative tranquility. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you brag about it? I be on the solo, making my money's grow residual. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you bragging about it? I be on the solo, making my money's grow residual. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA. They say they get me, I don't think they ever got me. My name's Kowalski, but they call me Kawasaki. I'm a line of funds, but in real life, I'm more like Chachi or Cola. I told you, I'm funky like granola. Bars. Can't you see that I'm a star? Who pumps his own gas in the cold really fast? I pass on your gold diggy stash. I'd rather make my own money, not advance me loan money. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you brag about it? I be on the solo, making my money's grow essential. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA. I was spitting when you was a kid. You doing what I did, you know I still got it. Why you brag about it? I be on the solo, making my money's grow essential. I'm individual, nobody's got my DNA.
So there you
go. Nobody's got my DNA.